attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business, and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Dave Dye, the true art director's art director. We recently had Dave on the show to talk all things Howard Gossage with Steve Harrison, but dragged him back for his own dedicated show. Since the mid-80s, Dave has been making memorable ads for the likes of Adidas, The Economist, Howie's, Volkswagen, and so many more, collecting awards and admirers along the way. The visual techniques he uses to squeeze every ounce of juice from an idea are frankly unparalleled. I love Dave's work, particularly because he avoids the hard sell and clearly respects the audience. On that, he says, I assume I'm talking to someone intelligent with a sense of humour. Some people's start point is, they're all idiots out there, so let's just make sure we get the brand name over. What's the point in that? If I create a TV ad and it's funny and it's interesting to watch, then you might watch it a few times. And if you do that, you've got more chance of remembering what its message was. In addition to creating ads, he plays a pivotal role in rediscovering and archiving them. His blog and podcast, the suitably named Stuff from the Loft, is a treasure trove of invaluable visual gems, spotlighting the work of countless forgotten or overlooked advertising masters. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Thanks, Charles. Pleasure to be here.
Right, seven quickfires, Dave. Posters or radio?
Posters. I do like radio.
Bergkamp or Henri?
Oh, Jesus. I'd have to go Henri, but obviously love Bergkamp.
Yeah. Number three, Steve Martin or Woody Allen?
I'd probably go Woody Allen, although he's obviously got some questions around him these days. But in terms of body of work, Woody Allen, I guess.
Well, I think if we're able to park that and, you know, make that a cleaner decision, makes sense. Number four, The Guardian skinhead or Canal Plus scriptwriter?
In terms of what do I like most, what do I think is the best, what I think I guess skinhead, it's such a boring, predictable answer. But the Canal Plus, I love partly because so few people seem to have seen it. And if I give a talk or something and it comes up, everybody loves it. So skinhead, I guess.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll link to both in the listing. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, find the link. Three more. This is easier. Soft sell or hard sell?
Sell. I don't know. Soft sell. What is soft sell? Soft sell, I suppose, is just doing something that people like. So I guess soft.
Yeah.
It sounds so flimsy when you say it like that.
I suppose it's more passive, right? But yeah, I think I expected you to go that way.
What people think is hard sell to me generally means direct, boring, and aggressive and not selling at all.
Yeah, I agree. Right, two more. A monkey drinking tea or hippos synchronized swimming?
None of these are clear, straight answers, although all of them are sitting on the fence. Probably a monkey drinking tea.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you were a fan of Flight of the Conchords, because that was almost...
Oh, yeah, I love Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, do you? Well, I should have asked Hippopotamus or the Hippopotamus.
Yeah, I loved Flight of the Conchords. I was gutted when they didn't continue making that after the... I think that was the... Was it the writer's strike or the... COVID that killed it off.
Yeah. And lastly, Dear Mr. Webster or Dear J-Boy?
Dear J-Boy.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I know. They are. Some of them are quite tricky, but it's out of love and respect, Dave. I hope.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just wish I could answer them cleaner and more directly. But anyway.
That's all right. No worries. Thanks for coming back on the show. There's a few things. We're going to probably shake this up a little bit and do a kind of lesser obvious agenda. But the one thing that you know that I'm keen to explore is your path, the early days.
Yeah.
I think there's huge value in people understanding that there isn't necessarily a right way to do things or to even get into the career. So can you start by telling our audience about your first ever job and then how that led to your first proper job?
My first ever job was as a paperboy. Delivering newspapers at about 14, which Sundays would be horrific because all the papers would be three times the size. and you'd have one bag and one skinny little kid trying to lug it through the street. That was my first ever job. My route to get into advertising, I worked as a sort of T-boy in a design studio, gradually doing things called PMTs, which were photomechanical transfers, which is like a high-tech version of a photocopy. And I used to read creative review, campaign, became aware of advertising, thought that looked kind of glamorous and exciting. So tried to do my own ads to get into that. So I would kind of, in those days, obviously you couldn't email anything. So you would have to draw them, pay to get them photocopied. Nobody would have a photocopier at home. Then put them in an envelope with a letter and send them off to an agency saying, can I have an interview or can you give me advice on this? Yeah, that would be it really. And often you would get no reply at all. Occasionally you may get, it's on file.
Yeah. And ahead of even writing those letters, was there any other intent, apart from, as you say, reading Campaign magazine and kind of learning about it that way? Was there any intent in Dave's early years to pursue anything creative, or was it all just serendipity?
Not really. I mean, I didn't know anyone in advertising. Weirdly, my dad used to decorate the offices of Saatchi & Saatchi and sort of talk to Charles Saatchi and sometimes come back and say, this bloke I'm working for works in advertising that said this, said that. So I'd hear a little bit about him. But no, it just looked, I think glamorous sounds a bit superficial, but it did look kind of glamorous in 84, 85. And some of the things on the walls, you know, when I did an interview with Alan Parker, one of the things I thought was really good that he said is, he said when he looks at a Banksy, he says, oh, advertising used to be clever like that. And there's a bit of truth in that, that you used to see things, particularly on billboards, that just seemed so super clever and stylish and funny and simple, you know, or on TV, you know, you would see, you mentioned the Guardian skinhead earlier. I mean, that's such a unbelievably clever, engaging, particularly then. I mean, it still holds up. So you would see these things and there would be less competition for your attention, you know, because then, you know, there would be three or four channels and that's it. There's no online, internet, no, nothing coming from anywhere else. There'd be films, music. So advertising played a bigger role because you didn't have so many outlets. And it seemed like, I wanted to create things that people liked and talked about on the TV or on billboards. It looked like a really good thing to do. So I used to, but I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how you went about it. So I would just try and make up ads. You know, I think, you know, that I think, right, Durex, what can I do on Durex? And I did an ad that half went down well. There was two rabbits with like a family of about 100 rabbits next to them. And it's the Smith family or whatever, never heard of Durex. And there would be no others. There'd be no campaign or no theme. It was just like cartoons really in a way. And so I'd make up these things and send them off. And as I say, really, I didn't really got any interviews. It's on file or, you know, one or two nice people may have said, come in and we'll try and guide you or give you advice, but not really. I didn't know what I was doing. And the only thing that sort of changed that, because if I was seeing people, and obviously people know the process of showing your portfolio, if I was seeing people and they were saying, well, this isn't a campaign, or what's your strategy behind this, or what's it, I would have learned stuff and improved. But because I wasn't seeing anyone, I didn't really know what to do. You know, they were politely saying, we'll keep it on file. I didn't know what the process is or whether that was what I was doing was good or bad, or I didn't know what to do. But one thing I did think I could change was the letter that I'd kind of, that I was sending these packs of either hand-drawn or photocopied work, because I think my first one was probably very hard sell, as they would say, saying that I'd worked really hard and I'm really keen on advertising, and it would be bigging me up throughout and lying, frankly, like hard sell, about how hardworking and amazing I am. And then I thought, well, that doesn't feel very true. I'll have another go. And I got caught up on, you know, on how to, in the starting, not even the starting sentence, but the dear John, you know, do I put Mr. Webster or dear John or dear Johnny or Mr. Webster Esquire? I don't know what the sort of, is it, should it be really formal? And I literally thought, I don't really know the protocol of this. I don't know whether to be really friendly or whether that's bad or whether to be really formal or whether they think, well, he's not very friendly. And I couldn't really think what to do. So I kind of wrote this thing, which started off, funny enough, I think I'd sort of had the idea from the beginning of a Woody Allen film called Manhattan, where he's trying to write the beginning of a book and he keeps changing it and he's trying to make himself sound better in the thing. It's a good beginning. Anyway, so I started off, Dear Mr. Webster Esquire or something like that. And then it was crossed through and then it said, Dear John Webster. And then it was something, something crossed through. And then it got friendlier and friendlier. Towards the end, it was like, Dear J-Boy or something, or Dear J, how about a tea, how about a brew, you, me, and it was like, so it went from being, so I basically covered all the bases, although I crossed them off, so it went from being totally ludicrously Victorian-style formal to totally like I was his best mate, you know, like I was writing to a mate. So it kind of went through that thing in order and it was crossed through. And weirdly, whereas before, I didn't hear anything when I'd sent the work off, or I got it's safely on file, which means it was in the big red round file on the floor, the bin. All of a sudden, I got response saying, "Do you want to come in and talk to X or Y?" So that one, the work was identical, but the intro was completely different. And I think, in retrospect, it was because it got through the gatekeepers. That in those days, all the creative directors would have secretaries, and you can imagine how bored they would be of opening letters from young blokes saying how clever and smart they are and how hardworking they are, and it's just so dull. So to have something different come through, I mean, essentially it's a bit of DM, to have something different come through that was kind of funny and but also had a bit of humility in it in a way. You know, there was a sort of little observation in it of what is the right thing, which was sort of true, although I'd sort of done it as a joke. There was a sort of certain truth in it, a bit of humanity in there. So that got me a whole, all of a sudden I had a bunch of interviews. The sad thing was, having got the interviews, that I didn't really have the work to deliver through. The letter was probably the best thing I'd had. So, but it got me a bunch of interviews, one of which led to seeing someone at a company called Brooks League and Bloomfield, and as he was about to kick me out after seeing the work, I think he even said, oh, perhaps you should consider going back to college, which was just a heartbreaking thing to hear when you're a working guy and someone says, you know, the equivalent of maybe you should go to Watford. You think, oh, that's a massive step back. And in desperation, I said, well, have you got a brief I can work on? Because I thought, well, it just slightly prolongs the engagement. You know, I don't get kicked out straight away. And he sort of looked around on his desk, literally just grabbing whatever was there and just looked at it and thought, yeah, that's a brief. Handed it to me and we were done. I said, oh, when should I come back to work? When do you need it? Or when should I come back? And he said, come back the same time next week. He was so uninterested. Anyway, so I had another couple of interviews and lugged around my big A1 folder, probably getting similar responses. And I lugged it from one place straight into the same guy the following week. But I'd done a load of work. I mean, I had no clue what I was doing, but I was just, you know, I was just creating paper. I was like, there's another one, there's another one, there's another idea, there's another idea. I didn't really know what I was aiming at, what I was doing. I was just trying to create as much paper as I possibly could. Anyway, I went into this guy, Barry. He said, oh, do you want to put your book on the desk? He's in a wheelchair, actually. So I said, yeah, yeah. I thought, that's weird. I suppose he wants to remind himself of what I've done. So I went through, and he went through again. And he sort of said, I think that's good to do with work. I'm not sure the strategy. I thought, God, he's telling me exactly what he said last week. And he said, well, thanks for coming in. You know, perhaps you should consider going back to college. And it occurred to me that he didn't even remember me. It was only a week ago. So not only was he not waiting expectantly for the answers to the briefs he'd given me, he couldn't even remember seeing me at all. So it's kind of a socially awkward. Do you think, how do I navigate this? You know, he's like the boss of this firm. I'm some urchin off the street. How do I, without making him feel bad, say, well, obviously, not only did you see me, you gave me a brief, you clown. So I obviously said something like, Okay, it's good to. Thanks again for that. And obviously, I've brought back the work for the brief that you sent me last week. Okay, well, what have you got? And I handed him a massive stack, like a 2-inch stack of paper, with literally like an idea on each sheet, but loads and loads of it. And he looked at one, and then I just remember him flicking. You know, when you see people flick a big pile of banknotes or something, they're sort of flicking through the corner. And he sort of did that and sort of looked off in the distance, did it a couple of times, didn't look at any more, which was lucky, really. But he said, well, why don't you come in for a couple of weeks or the month, I think it was. Come in, see how you get on. Come in for a month. I think partly, again, in retrospect, I think partly he's probably a little bit guilty that he'd forgotten that he'd given me the brief and he'd forgotten I was coming in. And I'd done such a lot of work. I mean, it wasn't good, but I'd obviously spent a lot of time creating this big pile of paper. So essentially that sort of luck, really. I mean, is it luck or did I earn that luck by creating a big pile of paper? I don't know. But there's a certain element of luck, really. I think if he'd have remembered, he might not have said come in for a month or a couple of weeks than what it was now. And that got me my first job. It got me working there for a month. And then I think in the second week I did a storyboard for I did an ad for a Shambolsi product called Hippopotamus that you referenced earlier. See the way we tied all these things together like a slick, which was for Hippopotamus, the launch of this pink moosey product called Hippopotamus. And I didn't know how you write commercials. And I somehow in my mind, again, it's annoying to have to keep referencing the tech, but at the time that was pre. Obviously DVD, VHS, I think even. And I sort of had a vaguely remembered Fantasia with elephants dancing. And I thought, well, let's have hippos swimming. No, I think, is it hippos swimming or elephants swimming? I can't remember. Anyway, I this vague memory of hippos or elephants doing some sort of balletic thing in water. So I thought, well, let's do something like that. And I'd done loads of little drawings, like a storyboard of hippos, like in a Busby Berkeley type thing. I don't know where it all headed to because I probably wouldn't have had an idea. It was just, I thought, well, let's do, it's about hippopotamus, it's about hippos. That will be fun to watch. And we can put the product at the end, would have been my thought. Anyway, weirdly, 2 weeks, I'd only been there 2 weeks. He quite liked that. He said, oh, I like that. What should it say at the end? And they got someone, one of the copywriters, to write an end line that said, Hippopotamus, come on, dive in, because obviously it works for the plot and the claw that they're all diving into. And then, you know, by the end of my month's trial, that was in production with, funnily enough, the guy who's head of Disney Animation at the moment, whose name's forgotten me, little tiny guy with a beard and a bald head, who was excellent. But so we made that. And then at the same time, the other thing he'd given me to work on was, you don't see it as much now, but there used to be lots of, when legislation would change that, say, lawyers may change that they could start advertising or different sectors maybe opened up to advertising. And Campaign or Marketing Week or one of those kind of magazines would get in touch with agencies, 3 or 4 agencies, and say, what kind of thing may they do? Should this, you know, this bill go ahead? And the one that was given to Brooks, League and Bloomfield, which was then given to me, was vets may be allowed to advertise. It sounds so weird now that they were restricted advertising. But anyway, vets may be allowed to advertise. What might they do? So, again, I did a whole bunch of kind of like cartoons. You know, there was like fish swimming upside down in a bowl. And I can't remember, there was one with a dog with its legs crossed that was saying, if you know, your dog's different or something. And then there was this one where a dog was cocking its front leg up instead of its back leg at a lamppost. And it says, something like, if your dog's got problems, bring them to us. And that one got printed. So within a month, you know, I had something printed in Marketing Week and an ad in production, animated ad in production. And they took me on because, you know, those things had happened. And I think I probably was sensible enough to think, I've got a chance this month. I've got a chance here. I've gone from not being able to get an interview to being inside an agency working on live things. So I think I took it and worked hard, and that ended up securing me a job. $5,000 a year, I think I got.
Wow. And how much of that, and even if we go not just thinking about the hippopotamus ad, but even just the letter that you sent to get your opportunity, how much of that do you think was you consciously breaking convention? As in, if everyone else was sending letters, so you thought you'd have to send a letter that was distinct, and how much of it was, I guess, just you wanting to do something fun and playful and entertain? Like, cause I feel like there's obviously something there that works and probably works to this day.
It's really difficult to know. I mean, I think you can look back and think, well, that was a really smart thing because it was different and it was funny and it was commenting on, you know, yeah, societal norms. But I don't think at the time I could barely write an ad. You know, I didn't really have a book full of, it's not like I had a book full of good ads and strategies and idea. I think from the outside, if you don't know anyone and you think advertising looks cool, you think, well, it's just fun things where people are enjoying themselves. They're doing things that are funny and that are a bit of a laugh and that are different and unusual. And that's as much as you go into it. So I probably thought it's a bit bolder than just saying I'm really good and I'll work really hard. I was probably aware of that. I wasn't trying to break any. I was just trying to get noticed and get a job. So I don't know how much would have gone into it. As I say, because the ads I was taking around weren't particularly very good. It's not like I'd lots of options. That occurred to me. I thought, I'll give it. Also, I didn't really know what else to do. You know, I suppose it made me laugh, this descent from very formal into very over friendly kind of made me laugh. And I thought, well, fuck it, give it a go. You know, I couldn't get a worse response. Nobody's inviting me into chat. So it's not like the response is going to get worse. Let's give it a go. So I wouldn't describe it too much knowing or brain power or anything into it, but.
Yeah, and I've got to be mindful. It's a slightly unfair question asking you to kind of look back in the rearview mirror.
Exactly. It was a long time ago, I think.
Yeah, formulaic reason as to why it worked. Yeah, but the reason I am asking is because it strikes me that something that different and distinct would be more effective or at least increase your chances. And I'm just bringing it back to the reason why we ask this question is because I hear from people regularly that are desperately trying to get a foot into certain agencies or even careers. And in fact, two people come to mind that we've had here. One of them, Charlie, his name was, recently sent in a spoof of this very podcast that we're on now, of him interviewing himself. So he played me and him being interviewed by him. And we've had another guy, I think it was a young writer. He was only, I think, to be honest, he only wanted a reply and some advice. And he wrote something, I think, not too long after lockdown and people had started resuming their workplace and returning to whatever normal was left, and he made a joke about how he'd managed to complete Netflix and just a few kind of whimsical silly things he'd done, and it just stood out just for the reason that no one else was saying that. Everyone else was saying what, you know, you suspect you were saying in your original letters about being hardworking. So I think the one piece of advice that perhaps people take is just think about what everyone else is doing and try and do something slightly different to stand out.
Well, I think that, I think the problem that we have as an industry is that we overthink it so much, you know, and if you're doing a £50 million TV campaign for a car or you're trying to write a letter to get an interview, you've still got to, you know, disrupt, as they say at TBWA. You've still got to do something that gets noticed, and it's better if they like it. Whatever I work on, I always think it's better if whoever sees it likes it. Some people think that's a bit indulgent because they don't have to like it, which is true, but I always think it's good if you do something that makes them smile or they like it or they think, well, that's quite clever or something. So you're still, you know, they're still the, regardless of the scale or the time that you're doing it, whether it's in 1985 or 2025, you're still trying to cut through, get your point over and get them to think, yeah, he seems all right, or they seem all right, or I'll give that product a go. It's a very straightforward thing. It gets a bit more complicated than that, but you're still trying to achieve the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few things. We're going to link to some episodes that you have done elsewhere and some interviews that you've given elsewhere. And this might be the moment that some listeners switch off, and that's fine. This isn't going to be a kind of chronological study of Dave. And there's going to be probably more listener questions than we normally have, which will probably dip back into certain campaigns and work that Dave has done. But I want to ask a couple of things ahead of talking more about your Stuff from the Loft work. We've ticked off getting starting in the industry. I want to talk about optimism and being optimistic. So you and I have spoken ahead of recording about how easy it is to perhaps take a cynical view of the industry as a whole. And I'm not trying to claim or pretend that there aren't issues in the industry that perhaps didn't exist in the past. And that could be anything from the decoupling of media to just the kind of financial constraints that agencies seem to be. Is there anything at the moment that you think we can and should feel really optimistic about in the industry?
I suppose I'm generally, there's a documentary called Art and Copy about American advertising. And my favourite bit is George Lois saying, you know, most good creative people are incredibly optimistic, almost like naively optimistic. You know, you get a brief and then all of a sudden it's like the best thing in the world. And he gives the example, it's a drawing pin. Look at that. Look at how sharp it is. You turn it upside down. It's got this thing. It's got that. You know, and you get really excited about a drawing pin that you've got to sell. And I think, you know, and I suppose I'm sort of still like that, but you know, the minute I get a brief, there's endless possibilities and it's exciting. And you think, God, this could be, what could we do? It could be amazing. And I still feel like that. And I suppose experience should tell you that you shouldn't be so naively optimistic about this next thing, or you should look at what they previously did and think, well, they've done crap for the last 10 years. Why are they suddenly going to start doing good stuff just because I'm showing them stuff, you know? But somehow that, I think that naive optimism that things can be good, things can change, that sort of, you know, or if you talk to Mark Denton's exactly like that. You know, he's most people I think who are any good don't feel down about it all. And I think obviously there are a lot of changing circumstances in advertising, but I suppose being optimistic, I think it's the perfect time for a sort of revolution where, you know, it happens every so often in advertising. I mean, the digital side of things is still, doesn't feel like people have got to grips with it, in a sense. It seems so unambitious, most of it. You know, I mean, there was a period when Crispin Poulter and Fallon were doing things and using budgets in different ways, and that you think, God, this could be amazing. And that seemed to be a little blip. And so there's a loads of opportunity. And obviously, if you're a creative, the best, you know, what you want is you want your work to stand out above all others. And whether that means winning more awards or being more liked or getting more PR or selling more cheese or whatever the thing is, essentially you want to be better than the competition. And if there's a period when the competition don't look amazing, then I think if you're out there with a pen, that's great for the individual. It's like I've been lucky to work on some really good things over the years, you know, like The Economist, the Volkswagen, or Nike. And people used to think, well, that's easy. You're now working on The Economist. And it's not. It's really, really hard. It's like, it's easy in the sense that you generally have clients on, you know, those kind of types of business that would buy things that are bold or would buy things that were simple or that are funny, or there's a, but on the downside, let's take The Economist. On the downside, you know, I've not been through the numbers on this before and I can't remember, but there are, like, internally at Abbott Mead, there would be 1,000 ideas produced internally and what is it, about 30 produced that the public would see. And that had been going on for, say, 10 years by the time I worked on it. I think it was about 10 years, maybe a little longer than that.
Yeah, how intimidating.
So internally and client-wise, they've seen, you know, internally people have seen about 10,000 ideas kicking around the office. Client side, they've probably obviously seen more ads than they've run. They've probably seen 300 to 500 ads, maybe 600. And you're on the same brief. And they've got people like, you know, whoever, they've got Abbott Mead would have had an amazing department from, I don't know where to begin naming all the people that were there, but they had some of the best people in the business doing those for all those years. So if you get the brief that says, right, we need a poster that says you could be more rich if you read The Economist, or you can be more interesting, you think, well, you're like, there's so much that's gone before you. You're looking for a little slither of something to hang on to that hasn't been covered, you know, because you go, right, so he's done this, they've done that, she did this, so you can't do those. And you're looking for your own bit of territory. That there are some things that are easier, which is that the agencies and the clients on those kind of bits of business are better set up for good work, but there's often so much work that's been done on that particular client. Like Nike is an amazing example. Nike have tens of thousands of brilliant ads done on that. You know, so if you turn up and you want to do a running ad on Nike, you look at what they did in the States, and it take you a week to go through it. Or it's so you have a different kind of problem. It's a better problem to have, because if you do something really good, you've got a very good chance of it going through. But it's not easy. What I'm saying really is, so you, to just get through those things, you have to be optimistic. So I would be optimistic that some young, smart people would say, there's a better way of doing this. This is bullshit. Why are we producing such dull, samey stuff? Shouldn't we cut through? Shouldn't we do that? And that seems to happen, like in music, you know, every so often there'll be a new bunch of people who come through and say, let's do this a different way. You know, it's just, why is it all owned by, you know, four holding companies that are making everyone poorer and seem risk averse to anything interesting creatively? Fuck it, let's have a revolution. So it feels like if you were looking for the circumstances for something like that to happen, that would be good. Time, weather, and
always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing, but we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
I think the whole point you made about even just going all the way back to when you're talking about digital kind of, I suppose, still feels relatively like it's in its infancy, but the opportunity there is the thing that people should focus on. The fact that few people talk about a great digital experience or ad that they've been served shouldn't necessarily be a negative about the channel. It should be seen as an opportunity to be the first or amongst the first to do something truly impactful and significant. And I suppose that is in many ways one of the key opportunities that we do have at the moment as an industry, is, you know, media becomes more and more fragmented. So what can we do with this? What can we actually use it for? Going back to your point about The Economist and even Nike and looking at the past ads, would that typically be your starting point when you worked on those briefs and those brands? Was it to see what they had done before and what perhaps they'd dismissed, or was it more researching into the actual customer itself?
No, I think at the time I would have been, you know, I remember when I first started working on Adidas at Lee Gustelani, I was given a running brief, and I was always really a big fan of the American Nike running ads, and I thought, well, I'll go through those to see what territories they've got. You know, there's different campaigns, different things that, you know, and I started to sort of research them, only again looking through awards books really, and it was kind of depressing. It was just in the end I had to stop, because there's so many, you think, well, I'm not going to have anything to write about. So it was just intimidating and sort of negative really. So I just thought, I have to sort of forget that and just try and think about running and try and think of something. If someone's done something similar, then we'll throw it in the bin. But it just became, because of the weight of work that they'd done at that point, it wasn't helpful. So generally, you know, when you would get briefs, then particularly if it was for the UK, you'd generally know what the history of that company's advertising was. You know, you'd have a sense of, oh, they used to stand for this, and then they stood for that. They did this thing that didn't work. Well, you know, you'd have a broad understanding, and you'd be looking for a new way of doing it.
No, that's interesting. And I suppose the reason I was asking about looking over past ads is, yeah, I suppose you need to understand the context of the brand and what you're trying to do and what's been said before. But also, and I don't know if this is a clumsy kind of nod towards your stuff from The Loft, but it strikes me as something that you've done in your kind of, I suppose, the last decade or so, you've been running stuff from The Loft, which started off as a blog and then I suppose has evolved into a podcast as well. Where was the kind of desire to start with? Where did that come from, that want to kind of archive and explore? Because I could understand it being both therapeutic, but also there's a kind of forensic and archaeological act as well.
I think it's because, I would put it down to the fact that after I'd got into that job, Brooks League on Bloomfield, I was there for about 3 years, and I would go, you know, by that time, I'd got a sense of who I thought was good, you know, GGT, BBH in particular, and some others. So I would try and I'd lug my book over there, and I'd got a sense of who I liked and what I liked. So I would try and, you know, I'd keep scrapbooks and buy books, and mainly out of, I don't know whether insecurity is the right word, but I'd be thinking, why is their work so much better than A, mine, and B, this agency's? It's just, what's the secret to doing something that's, you know, you'd see something like, you know, the LWT posters that GGT did, and it was like from another planet compared to what was happening at the place I was. It was just, it seemed like, you know, we were playing golf and they were playing football. It's just like there didn't seem to be much link between the two. And so I would try and buy any book or magazine about advertising to try and pick up clues on how you did stuff like that. And that continued till today, I suppose. I mean, that sort of continued on and then branched out into books on photography and books on typography and books on everything, really. So I always used to collect a lot of stuff, mainly for that reason. Whereas I think if I'd have written my dear Mr. John Hegarty letter and he'd offered me a job, I wouldn't have thought about other places. I'd have just sat in my office and tried to do good work that he approved. And I wouldn't think, yeah, but what about GGT? What are they doing? Or how do they do, you know, I'll just be trying to do stuff there. So I think that sort of certainly got me reading a lot of stuff, cutting out things. I used to keep scrapbooks at Liga Stellini. We all used to keep these big green scrapbooks with stuff. Ironically, they probably all had the same stuff in because there wasn't many magazines to cut the things out from. But we duplicated those over and over. So yeah, we'd have these.
That's interesting. I assumed it happened kind of, you know, later on in your career, perhaps. I didn't realize it was an ongoing thing.
No, it was. Yeah, I think while I was doing it, yeah, I was doing it back in Liga Stellini. And then I remember when Tony and Kim turned up, they also kept scrapbooks. And then they decided they liked the big green ones that I had, but they were keeping their own scrapbooks. So we were trying to find good stuff, ideally sort of slightly exotic stuff, maybe from the States or somewhere, or some bit of type from Italian Vogue, or bits and pieces that I suppose the reason we were keeping it is because we're thinking we've got a bit of information that, in theory, that nobody else has got, although me, Tony and Kim and whoever else have books probably all have the same bits. But it's because you think that bit of reference I could use and nobody else would have seen that copy of Italian Vogue or that ad from Goodby's about Fresh Mex, you know, that might be good for a chip shop over here or something, I don't know. But so you keep these things thinking they're going to be launch pads to other things. Now, I kept loads of these, and then I would also stick my own work in books. I mean, in retrospect, it's for the same reason, because you think there was, you know, we did some really good stuff on Harrods, and I would keep the rejects. I think I might be able to use those for something else. I look at them now and think, it's an ad for a military-style coat that's expensive for Harrods. What's the chance that I'm ever going to get that brief again? I mean, I would have kept, because you had to work so hard at Lucas,
yeah,
would have kept, you know, 20 scaled-down little roughs that we would have presented Tim and stuck them in a book. You think, that brief's not coming round again, you know. But I wouldn't have kept it because I thought, oh, they're all so good, I better hold on to them. I kept them because I thought it might be, you know, if we get a brief like that again, there might be something we can use. So I kept lots of that stuff, which I end up being useful when I do your blog on that sort of thing. But it was, again, it was kept not because I thought, wow, this is amazing, let's keep this for posterity. It was kept because I thought it might be useful if I was stuck on another brief. I think virtually with all of the reference books and all of the books with my work in it that I kept, I never used any of it again. I mean, you know, when you're cutting out bits of reference on, you know, from photographers or a bit of design it's going in. So, you know, I may have been influenced by bits of it, but I never consciously remember ever going to a book thinking, let's do it like that or let's redo that idea. Weirdly, I don't, you know, so that was the purpose for doing it for that reason. But I don't remember it ever happening because normally you get a brief and it's a very particular thing. And as I say, it's quite exciting when you start on it and you don't look at old stuff. It's just more exciting to try and do some new stuff than think, well, what did we do 3 years ago at Beavis?
Yeah, I mean, it could even be partly like, what do they call it, the IKEA effect, that when you build something yourself, it's got so much more perceived value in it because you've done it. So maybe like the heavy lifting you would put into an ad that you knew wasn't going to be used, you didn't feel right discarding it. So maybe it was a case of like retaining that heavy thinking.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of that. That's why I find it really strange that I seem to be the only person who kept a lot of their stuff, because I do, you know, my podcast, and I'll interview all sorts of people, Chris Wilkins or Jeff Stark, or, and I go, right, what, let's start getting your work together. What have you got? And they'll go, nothing at all. And you go, what, you haven't kept anything? And go, no, not at all. I burnt it all in the garden. I think Indra Sinha said he burnt all his stuff in a bonfire in the garden. You think, well, how much space was that taking up? A portfolio full of work, a couple of tapes and a...
Did he say why he burnt?
It's really common. Paul Leaves, same. Jeff, I mean, loads and loads. So it's not even that they haven't got much, they haven't got anything. It's obviously some, I would say, some psychological thing about moving on or whatever. But then obviously, then often I'll talk to them and it may be 5 or 10 years after that. And there's a little bit of them are like, I probably shouldn't have done that. It's a bit silly, really. I don't know what, but it's very common. There's barely anyone who've kept a lot of stuff, you know. So I suppose I started doing that, I'd kept a lot of stuff. I mean, initially, when I was doing a blog, I thought, well, I own DaveDyer.com. I'll just scan and dump everything on there so that I can access it, because I had loads and loads of big folders full of drawings and proofs and all sorts. And I thought, well, it'd be good to have it in one place. I'll dump it on that site. And then as I started going through that process, I thought, well, I may as well write what happened on that, because, you know, when you pitch, often if there's something relevant, let's say I'm pitching for Oxfam and I've done Christian Aid, then you have to run through what you did on Christian Aid and why and what happened. And so I kind of knew all the stories and stuff for that. And sometimes I would have the scribbles and a campaign we rejected and then the final thing we pitched with and then what ran. So there was different sections of it. So I kind of started laying it out in that order and then thought, well, I might as well make it public, you know, people can have a look if they want, but it doesn't matter to me. So it kind of started like that, really.
Yeah, that was my next question, actually, Dave, is at what point did it become a public archive, or did it seem to make sense for it to be opened up rather than being a personal archive and collection?
As I say, I started doing it, I thought, and I think it's literally, I can't remember now, but I think it was, do you want it secret or do you want it? It's as if there's a button there. Do you want it secret or available for anyone to look at? And I thought, well, I might as well let anyone look. And I didn't. And then somehow people chanced upon it and it started to get a lot of people looking and commenting and sort of built from there. And then I guess almost by accident, really, started to do interviews with people. I mean, there was no plan. I was trying to find, funny enough, Tommy Gallagher was kind of very involved in the decisions to not just show my stuff, to write about other people, because I tried to find some of his work for something I was working on, and I could barely find any of it on the internet, which sounds ridiculous now, but it would have been maybe 8 years ago, 9 years, I don't know. And I thought, well, I've got loads of his stuff in books. I'm gonna write something about him with his work, and then other people can see his stuff, because it's unbelievable that you can't find lots of it on the internet. So I did that, and then that kind of led to me interviewing someone who used to work for Tom. And then by sort of weird coincidence, so that sort of opened up doing interviews. And then by some sort of weird coincidence in the timing, I'd been to Cannes for one of the only two times I've ever been. It's not really my thing. And someone at Cannes said, you should do your interviews as a podcast, which sounded a bit ridiculous to me. But he said, everyone's, you know, listening to podcasts, you should do it as that. You know, you get a different kind of audience as well. And at the same time, while I was kind of thinking about that, someone got back in touch with me who I'd seen, whose dad used to work with Tom McGallagher, because I was going to do an interview with him, and it's gave me his phone number. And that ended up being my first podcast, weirdly. So Tom McGallagher was our first non-me blog post and my first podcast.
And how did it go? Did you enjoy it?
I did, yeah. I mean, you know, I was such a huge fan of his work. I didn't really know what to expect. Yeah, I mean, I partly wish I'd done it further down the line, because I would have been probably, you know, I'm probably about 70 or 80 in now, so I probably would have been better doing it now. But to be honest, you'll have all your questions that you want answered, and they probably wouldn't change that much. I probably would have felt slightly more comfortable. But he was brilliant. I thought he may be a little bit angry or mean for I don't know why. I know he'd had an issue with drink. I know he'd been fired from Fallon McGilligan, and I know that lots of people from Fallon McGilligan didn't know where he lived, and all of those things suggested someone who wasn't happy. And he couldn't have been, I couldn't be more wrong. He was like absolutely delightful, funny. He's brilliant. Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. But the only slightly tricky thing was emailing him is sometimes I'd say, I'm looking for this ad, or should we record next? And there would be no answer for 2 weeks. And he said, oh, sorry, I haven't looked at my email for 2 weeks or so. So that's the kind of life he lives. But he couldn't have been lovelier. And there were certain things I thought, should I ask this? Should I ask that? I don't want to be too personal. He said, before we start, he said, I haven't done an interview for 20 years. He said, I don't suppose I'm ever going to do another one. So ask me whatever the hell you like. which was great. Great way to start. Yeah. So it was great. I like doing that.
And does it feel any different to you when you, I mean, the word capture is probably not the right one, but when you capture somebody in a podcast episode versus capturing/rediscovering and archiving their work, what does it add that perhaps wasn't there previously?
When you do it audio rather than written.
Yeah.
The thing that finally got me to start doing them with audio rather than written, because I think 10 years ago I used to send out a Word document with a bunch of questions and someone would fill it in and send it back, essentially, except for when I got to do Joe Sedlmeyer, who was about 80, I think, at the time. And he said, yeah, I'll happily do it. He says, but I don't want to write a load of stuff. I'll talk to you, but I don't want to write a load of stuff. So I said, oh, okay, fine. I thought it's fine. I'll talk to him and I'll transcribe it. So we talked for about 2 or 3 hours and he was fantastic. And then I played it back, and in my cack-handed way typing, it took me hours and hours and hours to transcribe it. And then what would happen is I would come across a certain thing and he'd go, yeah, so then I got back from McCann's. They said, no, we're going to have to cut it. And I thought, fuck them, fuck McCann's, those fucking fuckers, typical fucking McCann. And you think, do I type that out? It makes him sound, on the audio, it's really funny. When you type that out, it takes on a different vibe, you know, and he swore quite a lot and it was funny. And you think, well, I don't want him to come across as being, I don't know, an angry sort of, it just didn't really look like what I was hearing, you know. So, you know, now and again, I would edit a bit to save his blushes or whatever. And I thought, it sounds better than it reads. And I thought, perhaps I should record these things. You know, I was a bit resistant to podcasting. It sounded, I don't know, a bit show busy at the time.
Yeah.
But then that sort of tipped me over the edge. And funny enough, I still keep meaning to edit that together and put that as a podcast, which I will do, put that as a podcast. I mean, it wasn't brilliantly recorded, but Joe Sedlmeyer talking about all of his work for 2 hours. So I should do that. I just keep going around to it. But yeah, so that got me over that.
Yeah. In terms of more recent work, obviously we spoke recently about the Howard Gossage show. How does that compare to what you were doing previously? And I know you've done it for more art directors and creatives, but as I understand it, with Howard Gossage, the archive just didn't exist previously, and you spent hours kind of forensically going through old copies of New Yorker and other printed literature, no doubt, to discover this work.
Well, there's two bits to that, really, which is one that I would, as I say, ongoing, I sort of build up files on people like a private eye and start putting all this stuff in it. And it just occurred to me that I love lots of Gossage's quotes, but I didn't know lots of his work. Even the Book of Gossage has not got much of his work in. It's got like a few really 10th generation photocopies. It's really weird that he's like a big name and he's, you know, Wyden talks about him, could be, all these people talk about him. But there's not many of his ads. There's a few ropey old press ads that are not that hard to read. Anyway, over time, if I would ever come across one of his ads that was in, you know, the New Yorker that was in a good resolution, I would just scan it and file it. And after a while, I thought, well, I should put out a post for these because I've probably got more ads than there are in the Book of Gossage and they're certainly better resolution. And I thought, well, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say about him. And I sort of couldn't think of an angle or what I was going to say. And I thought, well, I know Steve Harrison is an expert on him. Perhaps he can write it for me. I sometimes ask other people to write these things, which eventually he did. And he said, yeah, yeah. And he wrote a lot. But because he'd done a lot of work, you know, I have this sort of slightly guilt of, well, I'm not doing anything. I'm uploading it. And it's got my name on the website, and I'm literally just uploading it. I thought, God, what can I add? You know, how can I add some value to essentially Steve doing all the hard work? So I thought I'd start trying to find more of his stuff. So, you know, we looked into what other accounts he'd worked on that weren't represented in the Book of Gossage or... And I started to just look around through various copies of New Yorker. I've got my own scrapbooks with stuff in. And it's one of those things, it's a bit like, you know, once you, things open up and once you start looking through these things, you think, well, that looks like his kind of thing. I wonder whether it's, you know, that's more like a Gossage ad than all the others that look like BW ads. I wonder whether that's it. So I think scan that, we'll look into it. And as I started going, we built up a lot of stuff to the point where, yeah, I think in the Book of Gossage, there's 48 ads. I think by the end of it, we'd got about 350, I think. And we thought, well, perhaps we should do it as a book, you know, perhaps print it and get it out there. We ended up turning it into a book.
Amazing. How much of that, you mentioned, you kind of joked you were a bit of a private eye. How much did you enjoy that? And like long term, are you must feel quite proud as a, I suppose, becoming a historian of sorts to discover and preserve this work, because it's important stuff, right?
I don't know, really. I mean, I sometimes, if people say things like that, you think, God, that doesn't sound like me. I'm much cooler than that. I'm not a historian. I don't know, really. I mean,
I don't mean it in an uncool way.
I know, I'm joking too, but it's sort of, you know, it's like stamp collecting, or I don't know, it's like now and again. I suppose I quite like doing things quite thoroughly. So, you know, I don't like the idea of looking into Howard Gossage a bit. You know, I think either try and do it until I've exhausted every fucking avenue, or not do it. So once I'm on something like that, you know, even recently I had a sort of spare half a day. I thought, I wonder whether any new Gossage ads have turned up on eBay. So I'll have a little look around, because obviously there are certain sources like eBay that their stock is continually changing. So if you're looking for a, whatever it is, a Rainier Owl ad from the 60s, it's pretty easy to just have a look and see if any new stuff's come in and whether that's part of his campaign. And it has. So I've found more stuff that's not in the book since then. But why I do that? I don't know, really. I think it's interesting for me, because essentially that could have been put out as three blog posts, you know, linked. And it is very different to have a physical thing in your hand and access that information like that rather than a blog post. You know, there's something about it which is obviously nicer. I don't know, it's just the same material, but it's obviously there's all the usual things you say. There's a sort of permanence, or it feels like it literally has more value because you have to pay for it, but it feels different having it in that format. I mean, I may do more books like that, I think. It seems to have sold a lot, and you know, if there is a market, I mean, I've got real lot of stuff that I've ended up collecting, scanning, tracking down. And if there's an outlet for things like that too, I may do more things like that.
Yeah. Is there anyone in particular you can think of or that you know?
I think it probably found a bigger audience through being a book and then being promoted on social media than being a blog post and promoting it on social media, it seems.
Yeah. Are there any other names, though, that you know whose work is kind of less accessible? Because there was always a romance. Well, I always had like a romance associated with just the name Howard Gossage. And I'd read Steve's work previously. But there must be others whose work is just, you know, kind of not readily accessible.
Well, there's one that I really love that I literally can't find anyone else who's ever heard of her, who's called Jane Trahey. And I've got lots of her work, and I think she's really clever and really smart and cool, and did a blog post on her. But I don't really understand why she is completely unknown. And whenever I speak to any creative people in America, I say, do you know Jane Trahey? Have you ever seen her? Nobody seems to know her. But if you look at, you know, she's got 10 times the work in award books in America than Howard Gossage. And I don't know what's happened there. I mean, she's got all of the traits that would make her a huge name. She was female. She ran her own business. She fought for women's rights. She was a lesbian. She worked on really cool fashion accounts. She was very bold and outspoken. I mean, did really cool work, I think. You know, there's a lot of things that made her very different from the people around her. But for some reason, I can't find anyone who knows her. So if I did it, I could do a book with her or the pictures. I don't know what the words would say. You know, I don't know how I'd find out. She's written a few books and a couple of them were turned into films. Yeah, I mean, I think she's really good. I don't know why I seem to be in a minority of one. So she would be the person I would instantly, if anyone's listening who knows anything about her, then get in touch. But she would be the person that would instantly spring to mind. It's primarily a lot of her work, not all of it, but a lot of her work was in the fashion industry. So she did What Becomes a Legend most, the Black Gamma series. I don't know if you've ever seen those, but the American. But yeah, I mean, I think she's, very good.
Yeah, well, hopefully someone out there knows a bit more because that sounds really, really interesting.
And then the only other person who is known, but who I've stopped and started on a book several times now, which is David Abbott, for all sorts of complicated reasons why it's stopped. But so I end up having a massive archive of all of his stuff at very high res and a lot of stuff that people don't even know that he did because it's pre-Abbott made and post-DDB. He was a French Gold Abbott, but yeah, that's got a little bit complicated. But so I was sort of half was going to, and then there was a problem, and then we were going to, and then there was another problem. But I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what the final, we'll see how many this Gossage book sells, and then if it feels like there's a market for that, I'll do some more.
Yeah. Well, I'd definitely be interested in some, in both, to be honest, but David Abbott especially, I haven't really seen much more material. I'm mindful of time, Dave. I think I'll move there now because we've got four listener questions. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. So apologies if we don't include yours, but as I mentioned to Dave earlier, we had a whole wave of listener questions in. I'm going to start with a question from Aidan Clifford, who asks, what should copywriters do to be good partners to art directors? start with an easy one, eh? Yeah. It's a good question, though.
I don't know. I think probably the most important thing for being a creative partner is that you get on and have a vibe and can take the piss out of each other and say anything, really, which sounds easy but isn't easy because it's a fraught business, you know, handing scraps of thinking over to each other is, you know, when you start off, it can be humiliating. Someone goes, you're joking, aren't you? And then a bit later on, there can be a bit of arrogance one way or another. So someone may fancy their ideas more than other for the wrong reason. So it's quite a complicated relationship, I think. So mine would be more to do with the emotional intelligence and the getting on and having a laugh than the technical things. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how great. I mean, also, I think there seems like there's much less division now between who does what. So I don't know. I don't know. I think, you know, if you create a nice vibe between you that's sort of competitive but piss-takey and fun, then I think good things come out of it. I mean, I think when I sent you some stuff over the other day that was stuff that hadn't won any awards or anything, but there's a lot of things in there that I'd, like there was a campaign for Volvic, I think, was that in there from BNP? I'd always remembered it. And there was a few things in there like this Volvic that come out of just me and Sean taking the piss out of the brief, you know, with the account people. So on that instance, they said, you know, it was at BNP, you know, the home of planning, and they said, oh, the brief is to say that Volvic is better because it comes from volcanoes. So we're like, right, comes from volcanoes. Why does that make it better? So it's fire a volcano, you know, it sort of goes through that. So it's on a hillside near that. So it's really good. I said, but, you know, so we began, but why? What is the, is it got volcanic elements? What's the thing that's, what makes it more delicious? And they sort of couldn't obviously come up with anything. You know, the brief was it's better because it's from volcanoes. So before we knew it, we were just making fun of these things, saying, if you're sick and tired of non-volcanic element-free water, then we've got just the product for you. So we sort of went into this riff of just making up a load of piss-takey things. And then obviously once they'd left the room, we thought, actually, that's quite good in a way, because all you're doing really is saying Volvic is the one that's linked to volcanoes. No one's going to rationally read a load of copy and think, actually, that is the better one for me. You're just going, you're positioning it. You're going, remember us, we're the volcano people. So if you did it in this piss-takey way, it seemed like they had a better personality and they weren't taking themselves too seriously. But obviously you still absolutely connected the volcano with Volvic and with the water. So we did a whole campaign. So that ended up being a serious campaign. I think at the last minute it was pulled. You can imagine once it had gone beyond the marketing department, that sort of thing doesn't really travel. But so it ended up being pulled at the last minute. But there's various things in there that have come from the, I'd say, the vibe of the room rather than the technical skill of the, you know, it's just a good vibe to spark off each other. So creating, so being responsible for the vibe and the team that you create, I'd say, sensible. But
we had a question in from Craig Sanderson. I know Craig, he's a brilliant art director. And I also happen to know he's working on this brand at the moment, which is why I think he's slightly nervous for you to know that. He says, what was your inspiration for those iconic ads for the Macallan? And how hard was it to convince the client to obscure their unmistakable bottles in the ads?
They came out of a pitch and simplistically, we thought it's really dear. I mean, I'm trying to think when that was. It was about 2005. So we thought they're really, it's really dear. So it's got to feel more. So essentially, with most advertising, you sort of experience it with before you read it. So you've got to think, this is very upmarket, sophisticated and stylish before you've read a word. And it's got to be super confident. So somehow writing about how exclusive it was, how expensive it was, and just showing a glimpse of it made it feel special. You know, whereas you show a big, well-lit bottle of Macallan, you're just like everyone else. It doesn't look special. You can see it clearly. You can read every little detail of how many fluid ounces and, you know, how much peat or wheat or barley it's got in it, but it doesn't feel special. And essentially, you know, they used to say at BNP that you, on beer advertising, you drink it with your eyes or whatever it is that you're drinking the advertising. That's what they used to say. So I think there are certain things like that in blind taste tests in most whiskies, most beers, people struggle to pick one from another, but they understand the personality and what it says about them and all that sort of stuff. So it was primarily to make it feel like this was the best premium one. Now, as it turned out, and I didn't know this at the time when we worked on it a bit later, the distinctive white label was a big asset, which we didn't pick up on too much later, because in the very dark bars in Asia, people were buying it, partly because it was so expensive. They were buying it and then showing it white label front so that people could see. It was a very prestige thing that was, that label could be seen from across the room. I don't know whether we would have done something on that anyway, but so it was much more about creating that vibe. So it was a pitch and we wrote a billion ads, took them up in a suitcase to Glasgow, and the suitcase didn't make it. So we turned up to the pitch with no ads. We'd written about 50 ads in a sort of Lee Delaney style pitch. So we had to sort of go to this hotel room where there was like a big worldwide group of people that come together to do the pitches and essentially say the dog ate our homework. You know, they said it might come back later, it might not. So they're all laughing and they said, well, if it does, pop back. And then it came back on the next flight. Then we went in. But what was useful with that is it had broken the ice a bit. So we didn't go in quite so cold. We came in as sort of slightly giddy, laughing. We found it. So it created a good vibe. But then we got all that stuff out and whatever they'd seen before, you know, sometimes things like that, if you've seen a lot of very serious stuff that's a bit boring and then all of a sudden there's something comes out that makes you seem unbelievably special and sophisticated and cool. So it kind of, by the time we did get that out, it got a really good reception and we won it on the work and they ran the work. Yeah.
Amazing. There's so many good lines, especially the art direction's beautiful, but I just love the good news. It costs $14 per year. Bad news, 25 years.
Yeah, there's lots of those. I mean, this goes back to that thing you said earlier about, is it hard sell or soft sell? I think it makes you lean in that. And I think, you know, the hard sell stuff of a clean shot of the bottle on a white background with a big line saying, it's really great. I mean, I think those ads are attractive and they make you lean in, and hopefully there's something in there that makes you smile and remember them as being quite cool. It's quite basic. It's like we'd say earlier, it's quite basic really, but
yeah,
that's the job.
Yeah, but also that's what works about them so much. I mean, it's hard to do simple ads, right? And it's so simply beautiful and brilliant and brilliantly simple. And I think when it comes to like talking about hard sell or soft sell, for me, the hard sell angle is as much about the media choice as anything else. And I feel like that sort of preconception that the right place, right time digital offering was the answer, rather than, as you have done for your whole career, treating the customer like they've got a brain. Is kind of the clash.
I mean, you interviewed Paul Feldberg, didn't you, last week?
Yeah.
And I interviewed him. And I thought you...
It was about 3 years ago. We re-released it because it was as a best of.
Oh, was it really? I didn't realize. Yeah. I mean, I think I loved interviewing Paul. I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was going to be more scary because he comes over on LinkedIn as like a big, heavy punching bruiser because he punches. But it couldn't have been more lovely. But... And I find it really interesting as someone who's as sort of smart as he is to just have a second take on what he used to do, what he thinks now, and that actually being liked or entertaining, all of those sort of things are much more important than he used to think. Yeah, and I think there's not many clients who want you to do that or let you do that because the feeling is that's indulgent and... we don't want to tell, we're not paying you to write jokes, you know, we're paying you to do other stuff. But when you're selling, you know, if you've got a whiskey, when there's a, you know, there's 400 other whiskeys out there that taste sort of similar, who you feel the most positive towards is a big part of who you buy. So, you know, the way you create that is with style and wit and all those kind of things. It's not with hard facts and rush down to the supermarket now type stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it's just our industry as well. I think it happens elsewhere. I've been fortunate enough to interview a few comedians as well. And we had Charlie Russell, her name is. She's one of the founding members of Mischief Theatre, who do the Play Goes Wrong shows. They've done like a BBC Christmas special a few years running. Anyway, they're fantastic. But I remember her telling me that even within like the comedy and theatrical industries, people look down their nose at the clown. I think they literally call it playing the clown. Their type of humor is a bit more slapstick. And yeah, it's that kind of snobbery, I suppose, that they come up against, that even though they're wildly successful and, you know, have sellout shows across the UK and the US, there's still like a misconception that because you're playing the part of the clown, that it's for some reason it's not quite as important or as highbrow and intelligent. And as you say, if you're being witty and you're making people, you know, laugh and enjoy the experience, then they're going to think of you positively. And I think there's so many things at the heart of what she was saying and what Paul would say and what you would say that we know to be true.
But it's funny, that isn't a more major way of doing things, isn't it? It feels like a niche thing that some people do. I mean, that, you know, when we were talking about when I wanted to get into the business and was seeing all those things around, and I mean, they're all things that would make me smile and would seem cool, basically. Yeah. Most basic. And that's why I wanted to get into it. And I don't know, you know, the equivalent of walking on a cross track now and looking across. I don't know. There's not lots of stuff that would make me think, I want to be doing that.
I think there's people that are doing brilliant work in that kind of space. Yeah. Funny enough, Steve Harrison was talking to me about some stuff we'd done recently, and he was really encouraging and talking about it's good to see agencies being irreverent. And I think that is kind of, I've seen more evidence of it, and I'm hopeful. A question from Jack, who's a copywriter. He says, they say good creatives mold to any brand they work on, but it seems all the greats mold the brand to their style. You seem to always be able to spot them through their work. So is it more important to write an ad that feels like Adidas, for example, or an ad that feels like you? I think there's a compliment there as well within.
It's a difficult question. I think I feel compelled to say it's got to feel like Adidas. But he's right that there's a thing called the AAR reel, which is where companies send in a video of themselves talking about their work and showing their work so that clients could view a bunch of them at the same time and pick who's on pitch lists. The most common thing said on those is that we don't have a house style. But it's generally a lie, because the best agencies, they kind of do have a house style, and it's hard to admit. But I think it's okay if, you know, if it, back in the day, you wanted to feel like one of BBH's accounts, which would be very sophisticated and stylish. And what, so there were, you know, it's a sort of, I don't know whether it's slightly a chicken and egg thing, which is that they would attract clients who wanted that because that would feel appropriate and they would do that. Or GGT, who would be very punky. And so I don't know whether that's them attracting those kind of clients or them giving that. I mean, I think, you know, probably the truth is most creatives and good agencies have a way of looking at the world, which comes through on all of their work. You know, I think Uncommon is a good example. I think, you know, all of their stuff looks very considered and stylish and simple and lots of good stuff. So consequently, I think it is possible that you could walk on a long archway tube and think, I wonder whether Uncommon did that. And I think that is a compliment, you know. So I don't know. It's a sort of schizophrenic thing that we all fight against, really, that we want to say that we completely start afresh everything we work on. But I think if there's a certain, you know, even the stuff we've been talking about, if you believe that things should be as simple as possible, it's better if it's got some sort of humor or wit than if it's dry. Yeah. If it doesn't take itself too seriously, that's good. If it looks a bit different, that's, you know, you can put all these ingredients into a pot and you think, yeah, that's going to create a certain kind of stuff. So I agree and disagree. I don't know, but it sounds terrible to say, no, you do what you want rather than what Adidas wants. But you know, yeah. So I don't know. The answer is I don't know, really.
I think you've touched on a few things there. I think you're right, and I also think that your point about like following like is true as well, because, you know, it's the work that attracts new work, and actually, if they're attracted by past work for the sort of commonalities of being distinct and being witty or whatever it might be, then it is ultimately going to create a common style of sorts, I suppose, in the same way that an author might write several books, but you can pick up their...
And also their work that an agency does attracts the sort of people who like that kind of work, so they do more of that kind of work.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think it's also like, well, you know, as a creative... You've got, if you don't do work that your creative director likes, your work doesn't run. So one way or another, you have to sort of conform a bit. You can argue, but, you know, the best example of that would be Liga Stellini. Tim had a very set views on what he liked and didn't like, and you can think, well, fuck that. But then no work would run, and essentially you get fired, or you can try and work within it while you're there. And, you know, and sometimes that would be really good because his kind of thing would be really good. And sometimes you think you could break out of it. But and probably most agencies are similar. I think most good agencies are more likely to have a style than bad agencies. Bad agencies often are less opinionated on what runs. So have a less defined style.
Yeah. Okay, the last one then I'll include is from David Moore, who's, you know, well known for his ads for ad agencies. He did admit this was partly self-serving, but I'm also fascinated to know what the answer is. And his question is, what's your favourite house ad and why?
Yeah, I'm just going to say whatever springs to mind. So I love Do This or Die, the DDB ad that breaks down about what you have to do to survive. He's brilliant. It was the first one that sprung to mind. I love the English Fallon-McGallagher ad that said there's now a waiting list for Skoda. And this was when Skoda went to them, it was a joke car. It was like in lots of comedians' routines. It was the sort of comedy shit car. If you needed the name of a shit car, it was Skoda. So to run an ad, a DPSing campaign that said there's now a waiting list for a Skoda is brilliant and ballsy. Did you have one, Giles? Do you have a favourite that you've ever seen?
I think Backbone. I know it's quite a...
The Y&R one?
Yeah, quite a common one. But I've always had so much respect for that ad. It's just beautifully bold and surprising and visually interesting and unexpected. Yeah, there's quite a few. In fact, I had David on a year or so ago. We did go through a whole load. And yet I always come back to that one.
Yeah. trying to think, there are millions, aren't there, out there? I mean, those two instantly spring to mind. So have you run any ads for your place?
Yeah. We do quite a few ads, in fact. It's why David first got in touch with me a few years ago.
Oh, is it? I've run ads for my agencies. Don't think we've ever got anything from them.
I think there's still a huge opportunity there to for agencies to do more. And I kind of understand both sides of the argument as to why some don't. But I also think, much like racehorse owner betting on their own horse, I think there's a signal of sorts to show you have faith in advertising. And I think that's important if you're asking clients to hand over their budgets.
It's probably better for staff and clients in a way, let's say, with this kind of agency.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. We did an ad campaign when the agency turned 13, and it was just silly, silly lines. It was a bit Kevin and Perry, Harry Enfield character. Yeah. It was you know, just to warn people we weren't going to answer the phone unless they text us first. And Glass would like to announce that. And it was just very,
yeah,
really fun. And next thing I know, Ogilvy were sharing it on their internal system, saying that we need to be more like this.
Oh, really? That's
nice. found hilarious. Yeah, they've been popular. And then, you know, because ads wear in, not out, and because we're lazy, we just repeat those ads every year, every teen year since. So we're 15. So we've had a few years of those. But yeah, they seem to be really popular. Done a few other ads, nothing of significant nationwide scale. But yeah, a few print ads.
David Abbott once saying he'd never run an ad that he couldn't attribute a bit of business one to, which is unbelievable. I don't know whether, I presume it's true, but it's unbelievable. Because also they did about 30 house ads.
Wow. I wonder, I guess this might sound defensive, but I wonder if nowadays it's more other things that you might be done, which kind of fall under the guise of advertising, like us. So, like, I know that we've won off the back of having
exactly. It's a very different environment from when he would have been clients reading campaign.
Yeah. So, I remember Tom Roach telling me that GasPads, I can't remember the words he chose. They were quite flattering, but I remember them as alarmingly high share of voice.
Oh, really? Okay.
Just because he just said, like, it's always you lot gobbing off somewhere.
That's what you want. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. Cool. Well, that's the four listener questions. So the last part of the interview, Dave, is our four pertinent posers.
Okay.
Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Chill out. I don't know.
Chill out. Yeah, it's not bad.
I don't know, because I think, you know, it's obviously a hard question, really. You don't know where you're headed. I think, you know, if you're anxious, you're going to get fired, or you're never going to get in anywhere good, or you, I don't know, all of those things. Is that why you end up doing better than you thought, because you were anxious and worked hard, or should you chill out? I don't know. You know, there are certain things. I remember there was a whole period where I didn't used to go on any, I commissioned photographers and wouldn't go on any shoots, just tell them what I wanted. Because I think otherwise I'm missing a whole week of coming up with ideas on this, that, or the other. And some of the shoots, I think, in retrospect, you know, there's one for American Airlines to walk around New York for 8 days, I think it was, with John Offenbach, trying to find interesting pictures of New York at unusual angles. And you think, God, what a lovely thing to do. And at the time, I would have thought, no, I've got a brief on something at Legas Tulane, whatever it was. That's a whole week of work I've missed, really, and it's not really going to make much difference to the pictures. So I'll stay here in Shaftesbury Avenue in a stuffy office with a pen. You know, there's certain things like that you think, why would I want to do that? That sounds like a great time to have paid in New York wandering around.
Wow. You've only got yourself to blame on that one,
Dave. So there are certain things like that you think, I could have pulled out a bit there. Yeah, so chill out a bit, I see, probably.
Yeah. It's not bad advice, and it's not the first time that's come up, actually. Yeah, I think that which isn't a bad thing. I'm only saying it because it's obviously true that there's probably a sense of anxiety, and, you know, maybe, I don't know. And I also take your point on board that actually, if I was able to advise my younger self, I might be in a completely, you know, batshit crazy situation now and maybe not enjoyed the success that you have. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
I remember Tim Delaney always used to say, I like advertising, I hate the advertising business. And I sort of like the bit of doing it more than the surrounding bits. But I think probably pitching, maybe pitching. I think no good can come of it, really, pitching. Having done a lot of pitching and being brilliant at it, really. But having done a lot of it, all the talk around pitching is just horrific, you know, for me. You've got to be their friends. Who's pouring the tea? You know, you've got to look collaborative. You've got to look, you know, all stuff, which is everything is, it becomes everything other than the actual answer. You know, I suppose my interest is in the work, possibly too much so, but, and when it becomes about everything else but the work. And also, I suppose for me, it tends to create a false impression. You know, it's all about trying to pretend you're X rather than, you know, in an ideal world, people would meet various people and experience them as they are and think, well, who do we think's best? Whereas obviously it could be less about that. It's much more about pretending to be something is how it seems to me.
Don't really matter.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think pitching, you should be able to look at an agency's work, have a couple of chats with them, you know, maybe have a drink with them, go to dinner with them. I don't know, have a chat, see what they seem like as people.
Have you ever taken a stance against pitching at any of your agencies that you've...
No, I think there's only one agency that ever has, and then that's often disputed whenever I say that, which is BBH. But they would say, yeah, but John would have everyone in the department working on it, and then he would, in the meeting, say, you know what you want? There's something, there's a pen, and as if you'd just come up with it. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but I have not heard of any others. I mean, the problem is you just rule yourself out of virtually all business, you know. It's you'd have to do it en masse, and nobody's ever going to hold to that. But I think, I mean, imagine if you got appointed on what you'd done or what your clients said about you. You know, if they phoned around. I mean, what if I was appointed an agency, I would find someone whose work I thought was appropriate to our company. I'd phone up some of their clients and say, what are they like? Are they paying, or are they quite nice? Are they honest? Are they, you know, get a sense of them. Rather than what are they like on Tuesday between 11 and 1?
Yeah.
Did they seem...
Yeah. I mean, this thing that they'll never have to do again.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like a good system, but I don't see that changing anytime soon.
It's funny you should say that because, I think the correlation here for me saying we haven't pitched for years and we don't pitch. Now, we're also not rich and we're not a wild... celebrated agency. So there's definitely a correlation there. So please caveat my point with that. But one thing we do is precisely that, is we give the names and contact details of our clients to prospective clients and encourage them to call them up or send them an email. And it's amazing how many of them say they've never had an agency volunteer that information before. And it has exactly that effect. So I find whenever we take the stance of explaining why we think the pitch process is flawed, it really qualifies the opportunity, and it either starts a brilliant conversation or it ends a shit conversation. And it's just, I mean, when you're only an 8-person independent agency, it's very easy for us to take that stance, right? I think it's important.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what I have done on a number of occasions, said I won't pitch for something. And unfortunately, you can't manufacture this. But whenever I've done that, it then turns from you pandering to get on a pitch list and hoping you get appointed to them saying, well, why? What could we do to change it? So the dynamic completely changes. And often, you know, I've won a couple of those things. And I said, we're not going to pitch for it. But, you know, so you think, well, why not do that every time? But because you can't, you can only do it when you feel it and believe it. You can't just... go through the acting of pretending you don't want it or you're not going to pitch for it. So there's a sort of awkward fawning. And I've heard, I think even Paul Feldwick said this, is he was sitting on a panel when agencies were pitching to them. And he said it was, I don't want to misquote, but I think he said it was like cringingly awful how they were sort of trying to desperately be everyone's best friend. And, you know, so it creates this very awkward dynamic, is what can we do to please you? And then obviously, and if you win it, that's your relationship. You know, you started off like that. You can't then snap into a different sort of...
Yeah, be the real you.
...thing, yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, I would stick with pitching. I don't think it's good for the client or the agency, really.
I'm pleased you've said that. And I think the only other person who said that before is Luke Sullivan, because I remember we had a similar conversation when he brought that up. Number 3, are there any books that you would recommend? You mentioned George Lewis earlier, and it suddenly reminded me of his Damn Good Advice book that I haven't picked up for a couple of years. So I'm probably going to do that.
Well, funnily enough, it's weird how these questions come out in a certain order. I would say Luke Sullivan's book is probably the best book I've read on advertising.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I used to read all of them. I've read quite a lot of them. And a lot of them feel slightly bullshitty. Whereas Luke's is fantastic, practical. He's obviously a brilliant writer as well. And it's funny, but it's very, you know, there's certain bits of advice in there that I read, did, and still do from his book. You know, the main one being, which I can still remember, I must have read it 30 years ago, which is, he says, sometimes, and for no apparent reason, you feel like you're on a hot streak. You can keep coming up with ideas. Don't leave your desk until that feeling leaves. And it's and it sounds like so obvious, but I can remember often I would be in places and then towards the end of the day, I'd get this sort of flush of whatever it would be, adrenaline, and start coming up with ideas. And then if you come up with, say, 6 or 8, then you've had an amazing day. So you might think, brilliant, I'll pick that up where I left off tomorrow. And then you come in the morning, you can't think of one for the whole day. Whereas after reading that, I thought, yeah, I'm going to do that. And then what I would find is I could keep going to come up with maybe 30 ideas, you know. So rather than stay, you know, rather than leave after half an hour when this sort of feeling, you think we're in good shape, I would stay until I was struggling to think of anything and I'd have a pile of 30 ideas. They wouldn't all be good. But so I kind of have always, since reading that, I've always stuck with that since, that it's a really weird thing how sometimes ideas fall out of your pen and you can't write them fast enough and yeah. You can't pick up that, you can't stop that and pick up where you left off the next day. It's like a, why that is, I've no idea. But that's absolutely from Luke's book. There was a few things in there that I started doing. So, yeah, Luke's book, which is called Hey Whipple, Squeeze This. There's a million versions of it now, but it's excellent and funny.
Yes, perfect. And then, so number four, Dave, we always ask every guest to dedicate their episode to someone. And we bestow that honour on you.
Yeah. Well, the person I did see that you asked this, the person I would say is someone who's just passed away called Brian Stewart. Have you heard? You probably don't know Brian Stewart. Brian was the first good art director I met. I met him when I was in my first job, and he'd set up an agency called Elgie Stewart Smith. And he's like, couldn't be a more difficult, cantankerous, sort of aggressive person in a way, except he wasn't really like that with me. He was really nice to me. He was sort of a bit fearsome, but he was really nice and helpful. And so I got fired from that first job that we started with after about 3 years. And I'd just seen him with my book, and he was quite encouraging. And I phoned up and said, oh, I've just been fired from that place I'm at that I've got to get out of. I'm now out. Could I come and work around there? They'd just set up an agency. And he went, yeah, all right then. So I went up into their loft on my own, and it was just him and Barry Smith were the only creatives. And then I was up there for about 3 or 4 months. So I'd work on every brief that they worked on, take the stuff down there, but I'd never worked to anyone who was good, who did things that I liked or done things that I liked. So I did a lot of stuff in there. Some of them they approved, but the client didn't. And he was very encouraging, gave me a lot of confidence that I could do stuff that he thought was good. And one of the ideas that I did that he and Barry approved, which was a big Observer poster that was the end frame of the Waltons, their house, and it had like 1,000 little lines coming out that said, good night, John Boy, good night, Mary Lou, good night, Billy Bob, this thing is like, and it said, if you need a bigger house, take a look at the Observer. So that was approved, and I thought, God, that's good. I can't wait to get that in my book, you know, save it being all drawings. And then he phoned up and said, the account guy here had a really good idea with your poster. Instead of a poster, let's do it as a radio, which was heartbreaking because I didn't want a radio ad. I wanted a big, glossy, glamorous poster. Anyway, it was made into a radio ad, and it was the first thing I got into D&ED. And then Brian then put me together with, he said, you just need a good writer. So there's someone he used to work with. But his previous agency, FCB, called Alistair Wood, who he put me together with, we got a job together. And then I would sort of check in with Brian throughout the years. Every now and again, he would help out, or he'd say, Brian Griffin's not busy, you should work with him, which I then did, the photographer. Or he would give me advice and just be encouraging and cool. And he was not really like that with lots of people, and he was so dedicated to him. Yeah, I could talk a lot more about him, but if people don't know him.
No.
But anyway, yeah, he was really, really incredibly helpful to me. And he's just passed away, so.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, first of all. And I, you know, thank you for such a significant and meaningful dedication. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to Brian Stewart. Thank you, Dave.
Pleasure.
So as a final call to action, this episode will have listings to everything we've discussed. I'll link to stuff from The Loft. I'll link to the Howard Gossage show as well. How else can our listeners get more Dave Dye?
I've got my podcast, which is out there. I do a blog and I do work. I guess those are the three. I sometimes play five-a-side football. If you're short, I don't know what else. I think that's probably it. It's probably all of the ways. Obviously, I do all those other things, Instagram, all that sort of stuff. So.
Well, we'll dig all of those out, and they should be on this episode listing if you're listening to this now. So, Dave, thanks so much for coming back on. You know how much it means to me. I'm a huge fan of yours, and I'm hugely grateful for your generosity.
Pleasure. And I was pleased you posted that picture of the Volvo ad, which I'd sort of forgotten about.
It.
But I really liked that when I did it, and it never appeared in any annuals. So it's good.
Oh, I adored it.
Publicity.
I limited myself to, I think, three or four that I allowed myself to pull out. To be honest, if it had to be one, it would have been that one.
It's weird, yeah.
Stunning.
I really like it, but nobody else. Well, it didn't win any awards.
Well, I don't think awards are necessarily the metric. Yeah, well, I mean, who someone said awards are, you know, awards are shit unless you win one or something along those lines. I'm hugely grateful, Dave, so thank you.
Pleasure.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share it and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.